admire your courage, Miss...
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr...
Bond. James Bond.
Bonjour, Monsieur Bond.
Where's 007?
I think he's attempting re-entry, sir.
My God, what's Bond doing?
Keeping the British end up, sir.
Well, tell him to pull out. Immediately.
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bond?
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Hang on, James.
The thought had occurred to me.
Looking for shells?
No, I'm just looking.
You have a nasty habit of surviving.
Oh, what they say about the fittest.
Do you lose as gracefully as you win?
I wouldn't know. I've never lost.
No more foreplay.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Bond Backwards, back at it again with these episodes. My name is Anders Holmes and I'm joined by my brother Adam over Skype, over Zoom in America.
Zoomraker.
Classic.
Hello. It's that time of day again where we talk about Roger Moore Bond movies. And I can't believe that we still have four to go.
It is
a trial, but you know, I think this film will be fun to talk about, more fun to talk about than Octopussy and View to a Kill. Because it has got some good features despite being broadly very, very stupid.
Yeah, I feel like with this film, it's entertaining. It's not as bad as people make it out to be or anything like that. It is silly. I mean, it came a year after Star Wars, and then everyone at, you know, Cubby Broccoli's office was like, you know what we should do? We should jump on that and make, like, a space movie with Bond, because that might put bums in seats and stuff, because sci-fi is in it right now, I guess. And
I know, it's so lame when you look back at that era, and there's so much, like, space nonsense is being made, and so much of it is just utter crap. And it's so interesting how that works, you know, when something unanticipated comes along, becomes a huge hit, and then everyone's quickly like, oh, how can we, you know, repeat this success? And it's like, well, the reason why it was a hit is because it came out of nowhere. I mean, Star Wars was a throwback to the, you know, to the 50s, to samurai movies and TV specials of the 1950s. Jaws was again, this throwback to the creature features of the 50s and early 60s. You know, you can't just manufacture this kind of instantaneous success, unless, of course, you then continue to make Star Wars movies, in which case you're guaranteed income. But Moonraker. I mean, should we just deal with the space stuff first?
Yeah, I feel like everything. I feel like one of the things about Moonraker that I noticed when watching it again fairly recently is that it's trying to copy the formula of Spy Who Loved Me, because it begins in, you know, in the same sort of way. Like the pre-credit sequence is just, it's just a rehash of the pre-credit sequence in Spy Who Loved Me. And it's like, they're trying to do the formula again, but adding in a sci-fi element to it. And like all the stuff leading up to the space stuff is fine. Hugo Drax is an okay villain. I generally feel Hugo Drax is the Elon Musk of the James Bond universe.
Yeah, big time. I mean, he's way more sinister now than perhaps he might have been back then. I agree. It's before the rockets actually launch. I mean, this is the jumping of the shark for me. I mean, this is why I wanted to start on this, because I think this film jumps the shark when it has us actually go into space and then have us use laser guns.
Yeah.
Because it's like, at that point, you're just like, okay, well, this is just a bad Star Wars movie. And with Roger fucking Moore in it. And that's just not... it just doesn't hold up at all. What I think, if you want to do the space thing, you know, you could. We've already had plots about, you know, we've had You Only Live Twice. We've had Doctor No, where it's about, well, Doctor No is about missile toppling. That's different. But you know, You Only Live Twice, a lot of that takes place in space. But it's, you know, Bond it's doesn't grounded, actually go there.
It's grounded in reality. That
yeah. In 1978, like only about what a couple of dozen people had ever even fucking been to space, let alone like gone out there to shoot lasers at each other. Like it's just. Just
how they were able to get a city in space and build.
No, exactly. Like it's too much. It's too much. Like no. And it is a cow turd that lands on this film. It just makes it so stupid. There are lots of other things going on in this film that are worthy of you know, of applause. I think for a start, the introduction of Drax and all that stuff in that manor house that's made to look like Versailles is so interesting, and the way that they kill that woman with the dogs is genuinely brutal and scary.
That freaked me out when I was a kid watching that scene. I mean,
they're not playing around.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have to show the woman being eaten by the dogs. That, you know, your imagination is left in that, and then it camera pans up and it's like, we're in Venice. It's happy. But still, it's like, fucking hell, a woman just got torn apart by dogs like just a few seconds ago.
But I think you're, I mean, to go right back to the beginning, I think the pre-credit sequence of this film basically tells you everything you need to know about what this film is going to be like, because you get a sequence on an airplane, there's a fight, they fall out of the airplane, and Bond gets the parachute off the guy, right?
Yeah, and Jaws, Richard Keel is back.
But that's right. So far, so good. And then Jaws appears. And you're like, where the fuck has Jaws been?
How did he get into the plane without being...
Yeah, he is not fitting in that onboard toilet on that tiny plane. Yeah. So where did he come from? He just sprung out of nowhere. He jumps out of the plane. There's a big fight. And Bond gets his parachute back.
Yeah.
And Jaws falls. Where does Jaws fall? He falls into a circus. Now, we've already talked about circuses with fucking Octopussy, but this is the Jaws falling out of a plane that he couldn't have possibly got onto into a circus tent is the metaphor for this movie. Because you've got otherwise what is a decent pre-credit sequence of, like, you know, great, great stunts of genuine peril, yada, yada, yada. And then it's ruined by a stupid, like, it's ruined by the Cubby Broccoli tendency to be like, what this film needs is clowns and zebras, and you know, it's like no, calm down. Because he's a showman, he's a ringmaster, and that he can't resist throwing all this shit at the wall. And everyone loved Jaws and Spy Who Loved Me, and we'll come to that in our next episode. But he's a great character in Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah, Richard Keel.
So they're like, let's bring him back. Yeah. But they bring him back in this cuddly way. They bring him back like he's like he turns into this like sort of comedy figure, and he's like Darth Vader. He's a good guy masquerading as a bad guy kind of thing.
No.
Yeah.
But then they pair him off with like a small lady with, you know, Pippi Longstocking hair and glasses, and it's, I don't know.
Odd. I mean, Lord knows that's cute and all. I think you have to have a heart of steel not to chuckle in that scene where he is in the cable car and they meet each other for the first time. I mean, there are parts of me where I just, this like hard-hearted attitude that I have to some of the Roger Moore stuff, like some of it actually works in this film. Like there are bits where the cuddliness of Jaws starts to work, but again, they go too far. I think the cable car is a really good idea. Like, I mean, it's like he's becoming less scary the more we get to know him, a bit like the Jaws in Spielberg's film.
Yeah.
And so the best thing to do then is to take some of the threat away and maybe neutralize him by having him, you know, suffer all these accidents, which he does. I mean, that happens in The Spy Who Loved Me Too. So it feels like that's within the parameters of what you can do. But then they go to space and he brings the woman with him, and it's just like, it doesn't make any sense, and it's just stupid. So the whole film is torpedoed by this by this tendency to go too far and to go ultimately to space. The Venice sequence as well. Venice is used really well. I love the Close Encounters reference with the with the keypad. And then you get the brilliant attempt to kill Bond with the guy in the coffin, which is like, that's so Roger Moore, that whole bit. The guy's even wearing makeup.
No, he looks a bit like the guy from Cabaret a little bit.
Yeah, it's like Joel Grey has suddenly popped out of a coffin and just throwing dice. And then, you know, the crowning turd in the water pipe for the Venice sequence is the double taking pigeon.
The gondola as it's going through the square, and then you see the guy with the wine for the first time.
Oh yeah, I mean that guy, it's fun to have that guy show up and he will come back. But yeah, it's like you could, I don't mind a gondola that can have, you know, that can be a speedboat. I do mind a gondola that's chitty chitty bang bang.
Yeah, I do. I just think adding that to it, because the chase sequence is pretty good. Like, you know, the moment you have like a boat chase through Venice, it's always going to be very exciting. But I think they just take, like you said,
Venice is the world's greatest film set. You could film almost anything in Venice and it'd be good. You could film an insurance commercial in Venice and it would be good.
Yeah. Venice.
But it fails. It consistently fails to live up to what there clearly is a good film lurking there, and there clearly is like a classy Bond film lurking in there, because they get Dame Shirley Bassey back to do the song for the last time. It's a good song. They have a great cast. It's Bernard Lee's last film. Roger Moore is still young enough to plausibly play the part. And just with a bit of tweaking and with a bit more restraint, this film could have been as good as, well, maybe not as good, but could have been in the same league as A Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah, I mean, that nearly was his last Bond film. That nearly was the last one.
What, Moonraker?
Yeah, well, I mean, there was like a big 3-year gap between Moonraker and Four Your Eyes Only, where they weren't sure if they were going to get Roger Moore back, and they were looking at other people like Timothy Dalton, but he was too young.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned that. I mean, I think they probably should have made this his last one.
It just felt like the ending when he's, you know, take me around the world, James, if that was his last one, that was kind of a nice little way when he'd like, sit, you know, the ship goes off into the sunset. You know, I think that was a nice little ending and stuff.
Yeah.
But it does have this thing where it tries to replicate the success of The Spy Who Loved Me, but they just, some of the choices that they made didn't quite work. They tried to follow the same sort of narrative and adding a sci-fi twist to it. And Hugo Drax and Kurt Jurgens,
what's his name?
Stromberg.
Stromberg, Carl Stromberg, yeah.
Yeah, Carl Stromberg's character, they both have these same ideas. Like, one wants to, you know, create a world where everyone lives underwater, and the other guy wants to, you know, wipe out everyone on Earth using like a biological weapon and then have like a master race to come back into Earth when everything's fine to, you know, start all over again. So, I mean,
I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, they're still only in their first decade of like post. In fact, they're only, because Diamonds Are Forever is the last Spectre movie, and every single Bond film except Goldfinger up to that point had been about the same baddies. It had always been Spectre. It had always been Blofeld. And this is the fourth film since then, and they've tried, you know, drug dealers in this sort of blaxploitation movie in Live and Let Die, which we'll come to. They tried the international assassin dude, and then they're like, okay, well, let's try and do, and that doesn't really work, so they go back to, let's do Spectre without doing Spectre.
Yeah.
And so they get these bad guys with these huge global, like, visions, dangerous billionaires, essentially, and I think they work really well as like bodies for the late 70s, or because they are like, who doesn't love a weird supervillain who's got loads of money and who's got this like crackpot vision about a world? I mean, and it is like Elon Musk, it is like some of these people you see out there in the world who are just like off the fucking chain. And
imagine Elon Musk or even Jeff Bezos, they have all these schemes, or Bill Gates, who's trying to find a cure for the coronavirus and everything like that, or funding for.
Right, and so if they were just a little bit more mad, you know, they could do all sorts of, they could wreak all sorts of havoc. The So I think this is a good villain type. And actually, you know, we talk about this, I think there's the stereotype of the Bond villain is still this like super villain with a crazy headquarters who wants to wipe out the world. But it's funny when you look at it, how few of the Bond films actually have that plot. A lot of them do end up being about diamond smuggling or, drug dealing or revenge or whatever else, or, you know, playing cards or something, you know. So I think this...
buying oil in a desert.
Right. Like, this is... this becomes this, this stereotype. And I feel like The Spy Who Loved Me is the peak of that. The Spy Who Loved Me is one of the very best Bond films, I think, because it gets that formula right and it gets Roger Moore right. And as you say, yeah, they try it again with this and it just doesn't come off. And I think the choices that they make ultimately are they try and have too many laughs and they go to space. And I think if they just pulled the, I really don't want to come across the guy who says, oh, there shouldn't be humor in Bond films, because they really should. Bond films should be fun. Just a little bit less in this one, and then like leave the space thing. Like, don't do that. And those are my thoughts. Do you want to do some fun features?
Yeah. What do you think of the character? What's her character's name? Who's the actress that plays her? Lois Childs as Dr. Holly Goodhead.
Goodhead. It's
a lot of jokes about that.
Yeah, she's not brilliant.
Sort of stepped down from the last Bond girl.
Right. I mean, we had Barbara back last time. There's a lot to live up to. So, no, I'm not like particularly interested.
I mean, she's not as bad as Tanya Roberts, but she's close.
Yeah, no, she's really not as bad as Tanya Roberts. She's way less bad than that.
She has some charisma, but I think there is like, I don't know, a bit of pairing with Roger Moore. It doesn't quite, I don't know, the chemistry isn't quite there, I think. Maybe a few more rehearsals, I don't know. I'm not quite sure.
Well, anyway.
What do you think? Like, is it, it's Michael Lonsdale as Drax.
Yeah, Lonsdale is good in everything. And he's really good. I think he's a good choice. He plays the villain really well. His little suits they evoke both Stromberg and Blofeld. He's younger than Stromberg, and he has this he has a sort of chill about him that's very menacing. I like him a lot. He could use better help. I think his henchmen could use some work, but...
also, I love when he's about to go, and he has many moments where he's like, I feel like I've killed Bond this time, and he's going to burn in that little room underneath the rocket. Drax, did you put him in the room with the vent or the room without the vent? Like, if only Bond villains, if they just waited just a few more seconds, just to
It's like it's the Austin Powers thing, isn't it? Just go in there and shoot it with a gun. Like,
I got a gun. I'm gonna go in there. Bam! Both of them dead. We can take care of it.
Yeah.
All right, zip it.
There's so many instances in this film where Bond is. They're trying to kill him in these elaborate ways. But I need to go. So can we talk about the fun things we always talk about?
Yeah, what's if you were going to recast someone, who would you recast?
Good question. I would do. I'd probably ultimately recast the Bond girl, because the problem is it's not the cast that are really the problem here. It's the story, because everyone is good in their roles.
Yeah.
So I guess Lois Childs is the weak link. So I guess I'd just like put a great 70s actress in there in her place, like, you know, Faye Dunaway.
Why not? I was thinking Faye Dunaway as well.
You were going to say that?
Yeah, I was thinking Faye Dunaway too.
Well, there we go. So that's official. So we're casting Faye Dunaway in this role, and she's going to make this, she's going to add even more class to this film.
What, I mean, just getting quick, I like the Shirley Bassey song. I think it's a big, I think it's that and Goldfinger are my favorite of the songs that she did. I'm not a huge fan of the Diamonds Are Forever song. And she nearly did the song for Quantum of Solace.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a song of hers I can't remember the album, but it came out in 2008. And someone, I might link the YouTube link in the episode link for this. And someone used the title sequence from Quantum of Solace and put the song that she did underneath. And it works a lot better. Also because it's not called Quantum of Solace, but in the lyrics, you know, it's like, where is the solace or something like that. But it feels part of the song.
The quantum.
No, it's like the quantum of solace or something like that. But no, the song is called No Good About Goodbyes. And it's just the lyrics fit more in with the tone of what they were trying to do with Quantum of Solace.
Interesting.
Yeah, I might send you the song. It's actually really good, and I like Shirley Bassey a lot. Favorite location?
I was going to ask you that. Take it in turns. Favorite location. What's your favorite location in this film, Andy?
Brazil.
Where would you like to go on holiday?
Brazil.
Ah, shit, you're talking about.
Maybe not at the moment, but at some point when things have quietened down in the corona field, maybe Brazil.
Yeah, so you're off to Rio. I will go to Venice then, won't I?
Yeah, I'll be dancing on the sand.
Mm-hmm. At a safe distance.
yeah, exactly.
What other things do we do? Silliest bit?
Probably the double take pigeon.
For me, I cannot get over the laser battle. It's just so like...
Yeah,
it's a year after Star Wars, and it's so the aesthetics is so naff. Like it's all these shiny, like squeaky, like.
But it's like slow. Like someone's playing with like figurines. It's like.
Yeah, it really feels like it's like the opening sequence of a Toy Story film.
My other second stupidest moment is the bit when he throws the Asian henchman into the piano, and then he's like, "Play it again, Sam." What's your best bit?
I think it's the whole the menace around Drax's manor house, and that culminates in the death of that woman. That's like. It makes us really dislike him. It makes him seem really dangerous, and Bond gets to be cool in that bit because he's
I like the introduction to Drax where he's just playing the piano and he has the dog surrounding him and had a very kind of Hannibal Lecter-esque feel about him.
Like, yeah, he's like this idea of a villain who's gifted and surrounded by animals. Yeah, I mean it's brilliant. What about you?
See to Mr. Bond. Make sure that some harm comes to him.
Yes.
That's my Michael Longstyle impression.
What's your favourite bit?
Favourite bit. I think it's the cable car sequence because it adds that kind of vertigo element to it with, you know, the stuff they did on sets and stuff. I think it's a good sequence.
Yeah, I mean, we love anyone who loves Where Eagles Dare wants to have a cable car sequence in the film. So yeah. I'll give you that one. So what are we giving it? I think probably for me, it's a 2.5 martini movie.
Yeah, I think it's like 2.5 close to like 3 martinis for me. I think it's like watching it again. I was kind of expecting myself to watch it and feel like, oh, this is going to be bad. This is going to be like a really slow watch. And I watched it and I was like, it's not as bad as I thought it was. I mean, it's not Beautiful or Octopussy. It's fine.
It is better. It is pretty much the average in terms of the Roger Moore era. It is, and it might even be slightly better than average. So,
yeah.
But I can't wait to talk about the next film because I think, as I say, I think The Spy Who Loved Me is truly up there with the best.
Great Bond film. I can't wait to talk about it. But yeah, so that's been us talking about Moonraker. So yeah, if you haven't seen it for a while, do check it out, see what you think.
Oh, and let's pour out a glass for Bernard Lee because this was his last Bond movie.
Yeah, this was his last film. Yeah, he was a great M. His presence is very much missed in For Your Eyes Only.
Yeah, no, and it's he was his absolute legend of the series. So yeah. All right, we can leave it there. I'll see you soon.
Yeah, see you soon. We'll be back to talk about The Spy Who Loved Me. So yeah, have a good day, everyone. Stay safe.
Bye.
Bye.
Stinging in the rain.
That's not funny, 007.
Where's your butler friend?
Oh, he blew a fuse.
Shocking.
Where's Drax?
Oh, he had to fly.
Positively shocking.
You missed, Mr. Bond.
I think he got the point.
Right idea, Mr. Bond. But wrong pussy.
You're not thinking that.
I sure am, boy.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Goodbye, Mr. Bond.
To Smith and Wesson. And you've had your six.
Well, here's to us.